ultimately fine. Go on, shoo. Meeting's at 7. If you hurry, you've just got time enough to get back here for some supper before. All right. He was at the gate which separated the front yard from the back when she called after him. Don't forget to ask him what he thought of Harold.
Don't worry, Stu said. I won't.
And watch his eyes when he answers, Stuart.
When Stu asked casually about his impression of Harold, at this point Stu had not mentioned the vacancy on the ad hoc committee at all, Larry Underwood's eyes grew both wary and puzzled.
Fran told you about my fixation on Harold, huh?
Yup.
Larry and Stu were in the living room of a small Table Mesa tract house. Out in the kitchen, Lucy was rattling dinner together, eating canned stuff on a brazier grill Larry had rigged for her. It ran off bottled gas. She was singing snatches of honky-tonk women as she worked, and she sounded very happy. Stu lit a cigarette. He was down to no more than 5 or 6 a day. He didn't fancy having Dick Ellis operating on him for lung cancer.
Well, all the time I was following Harold, I kept telling myself he probably wouldn't be like I pictured him. And he wasn't. But I'm still trying to figure out what it is about him. He was pleasant as hell, a good host. He cracked the bottle of wine I brought him, and we toasted each other's good health. I had a good time, but...
But?
We came up behind him, Leo and me. He was putting a brick wall around this flower garden, and he whirled around, didn't hear us coming until I spoke up, I guess. And for a minute there, I'm saying to myself, holy God, this dude is going to kill me.
Lucy came into the doorway.
Stu, can you stay for dinner? There's plenty.
Thanks, but Franny expects me back. I can only stay 15 minutes or so.
Sure?
Next time, Lucy, thanks.
Okay.
She went back into the kitchen.
Did you come just to ask about Harold?
Larry asked.
No, Stu said, coming to a decision. I came to ask if you'd serve on our little ad hoc committee. One of the other guys, Dick Ellis, had to say no.
Like that, is it?
Larry went to the window and looked out on the silent street.
I thought I could go back to being a private again.
Your decision, of course. We need one more. You were recommended.
By who, if you don't mind me?
We asked around. Franny seems to think you're pretty level. And Nick Andros talked, well, he doesn't talk, but you know, to one of the men that came in with you, Judge Ferris.
Larry looked pleased. The judge gave me a recommendation, huh? Well, that's great. You know, you ought to have him. He's smart as a devil.
That's what Nick said. But he's also 70, and our medical facilities are pretty primitive.
Larry turned to look at Stu, half smiling.
This committee isn't quite as temporary as it looks on the face of it, is it?
Stu smiled and relaxed a little. He still hadn't really decided how he felt about Larry Underwood, but it was clear enough the man hadn't fallen off a hayrick yesterday.
Well, let's put it this way. We'd like to see our committee stand for election to a full term.
Preferably unopposed, Larry said.
His eyes on Stu were friendly, but sharp. Very sharp.
Can I get you a beer?
I better not. Had a few too many with Glenn Bateman a couple nights ago. Fran's a patient girl, but her patience only stretches so far.
What do you say, Larry? Want to ride along?
I guess... Oh, hell, I say yes. I thought nothing in the world would make me happier than to get here and dump my people and let somebody else take over for a change. Instead, pardon my French, I've been just about bored out of my tits.
We're having a little meeting tonight at my place to talk over the big meeting on the 18th. Think you could come?
Sure, can I bring Lucy?
Stu shook his head slowly.
Nor talk to her about it. We want to keep some of this stuff close for a while.
Larry's smile evaporated.
I'm not much on cloak and dagger, Stu.
I better get that up front because it might save a hassle later.
I think what happened in June happened because too many people were playing it a little too close. That wasn't any act of God. That was an act of pure human fuckery.
That's one you don't want to get into with Mother, Stu said.
He was still smiling, relaxed.
As it happens, I agree with you. But would you feel the same way if it was wartime?
I don't follow you. That man we dreamed about. I doubt if he's just gone away.
Larry looked startled, considering. Glenn says he can understand why nobody's talking about that, Stu went on, even though we've all been warned. The people here are still shell-shocked. They feel like they've been through hell to get here. All they want to do is lick their wounds and bury their dead. But if Mother Abigail's here, then he's there.
Stu jerked his head toward the window, which gave on a view of the Flatirons rising in the high summer haze.
And most of the people here may not be thinking about him, but I'd bet my bottom dollar that he's thinking about us.
Larry glanced at the doorway to the kitchen, but Lucy had gone outside to talk to Jane Hovington from next door.
You think he's after us, he said in a low voice.
That's a nice thought to have just before dinner. Good for the appetite.
Larry, I'm not sure of anything myself, but Mother Abigail says it won't be over one way or the other until he's got us or we've got him.
I hope she's not saying that around. These people would be headed for fucking Australia.
Thought you didn't hold much with secrets.
Yeah, but this...
Larry stopped. Stu was smiling kindly, and Larry smiled back, rather sourly.
Okay, your point. We talk it out and keep our mouths shut.
Fine. See you at 7.
Sure thing.
They walked to the door together.
Thank Lucy for the invite again, Stu said. Franny and I'll take her up on it before long.
Okay.
As Stu reached the door, Larry said, Hey.
Stu turned back, questioning.
There's a boy, Larry said slowly, that came across from Maine with us. His name is Leo Rockway. He's had his problems. Lucy and I sort of share him with a woman named Nadine Cross. Nadine's a little out of the ordinary herself, you know.
Stu nodded.
There had been some talk about a peculiar little scene between Mother Abigail and the Cross woman when Larry brought his party in.
Nadine was taking care of Leo before I ran across them. Leo kind of sees into people.
He's not the only one either. Maybe there were always people like that, but there seems to be a little bit more of it around since the flu. And Leo, he wouldn't go into Harold's house. Wouldn't even stay on the lawn. That's sort of funny, isn't it?
It is, Stu agreed.
They looked at each other thoughtfully for a moment, and then Stu left to go home and get his supper. Fran seemed preoccupied herself during the meal and didn't talk much. And while she was doing the last of the dishes in a plastic bucket full of warm water, people began arriving for the first meeting of the Free Zone Ad Hoc Committee. After Stu had gone over to Larry's, Franny rushed upstairs to the bedroom. In the corner of the closet was the sleeping bag she had carried across the country strapped to the back of her motorcycle. She had kept her personal belongings in a small zipper bag. Most of these belongings were now distributed through the apartment she and Stu shared, but a few still hadn't found a home and rested at the foot of the sleeping bag. There were several bottles of cleansing cream. She had suffered a sudden rash of skin outbreaks after the deaths of her mother and father, but that had now subsided. A box of stay-free mini pads in case she started spotting. She had heard that pregnant women sometimes did. Two boxes of cheap cigars, one marked It's a Boy and the other marked It's a Girl. The last item was her diary. She drew it out and looked at it speculatively. She had entered in it only 8 or 9 times since their arrival in Boulder, and most of the entries had been short, almost elliptical. The great outpouring had come and gone while they were still on the road. Like afterbirth, she thought a little ruefully. She hadn't entered at all in the last 4 days, and suspected that the diary might eventually have slipped her mind altogether, although she had firmly intended to keep it more fully when things settled down a little. For the baby. Now, however, it was very much on her mind once more. The way people get when they convert to religion, or read something that changes their lives, like intercepted love letters. Suddenly it seemed to her that the book had gained weight, and that the very act of turning back the pasteboard cover would cause sweat to pop out on her brow and she suddenly looked back over her shoulder, her heart beating wildly. Had something moved in here? A mouse, scuttering behind the wall, maybe. Surely no more than that. more likely just her imagination. There was no reason at all for her to suddenly be thinking of the man in the black robe, the man with the coat hanger. Her baby was alive and safe, and this was just a book, and anyhow, there was no way to tell if a book had been read, and even if there was a way, there would be no way to tell if the person who had read it had been Harold Lauder. Still, she opened the book and began to turn slowly through its pages, getting shutter clicks of the recent past like black-and-white photographs taken by an amateur. Home movie of the mind. Tonight we were admiring them, and Harold was going on about color and texture and tone, and Stu gave me a very sober wink. Evil me, I winked back. Harold will object on general principles, of course. Damn you, Harold, grow up. And I could see him getting ready with one of his patented Harold Lauder smart-ass comments. My God, Fran, why did you ever say all those things about him? To what purpose? Well, you know Harold, his swagger, all those pompous words and pronouncements, an insecure little boy. That was July 12th. Wincing, she turned past it rapidly, fluttering through the pages now, in a hurry to get to the end. Phrases still leaped up, seeming to slap at her. Anyway, Harold smelled pretty clean for a change. Harold's breath would have driven away a dragon tonight. And another, seeming almost prophetic, he stores up rebuffs like pirate treasure. But to what purpose? To feed his own feelings of secret superiority and persecution? Or was it a matter of retribution? Oh, he's making a list, and checking it twice. He's gonna find out who's naughty and nice. Then, on August 1st, only 2 weeks ago, the entry started at the bottom of a page. No entry last night. I was too happy. Have I ever been this happy? I don't think so. Stuart and I are together. We... End of the page. She turned to the next one. The first words at the top of the page were, "Made love twice." But they barely caught her eye before her glance dropped halfway down the page. There, beside some blathering about the maternal instinct, was something that caught her eyes and froze her almost solid. It was a dark, smeary thumbprint. She thought wildly. I was riding on a motorcycle all day long, every day. Sure, I took care to clean up every chance I got, but your hands get dirty and... She put out her hand, not at all surprised to see that it was shaking badly. She put her thumb on the smudge. The smudge was a lot bigger. Well, of course it is, she told herself. When you smear something around, it naturally gets bigger, that's why. That's all that is. But this thumbprint wasn't that smeared. The little lines and loops and whorls were still clear for the most part. And it wasn't grease or oil. There was no use even kidding herself that it was. It was dried chocolate. Paydays, Fran thought sickly. Chocolate-covered payday candy bars. For a moment she was afraid to do so much as turn around, afraid that she might see Harold's grin hanging over her shoulder like the grin of the Cheshire Cat in Alice. Harold's thick lips moving as he said solemnly, "Every dog has his day, Franny. Every dog has his day." But even if Harold had sneaked a glance into her diary, did it have to mean he was contemplating some secret vendetta against her or Stu or any of the others? Of course not. But Harold's changed, an interior voice whispered. God damn it, he hasn't changed that much, she cried to the empty room. She flinched a little at the sound of her own voice, then laughed shakily. She went downstairs and began to get supper. They would be eating early because of the meeting. But suddenly the meeting didn't seem as important as it had earlier. Excerpts from the minutes of the ad hoc committee meeting, August 13, 1990. The meeting was held in the apartment of Stu Redman and Francis Goldsmith. All members of the ad hoc committee were present, those being Stuart Redman, Francis Goldsmith, Nick Andros, Glenn Bateman, Ralph Brentner, Susan Stern, and Larry Underwood. Stu Redman was elected moderator of the meeting. Francis Goldsmith was elected recording secretary. These notes, plus complete coverage of every burp, gurgle, and aside, all recorded on Memorex cassettes for anyone crazy enough to want to listen to them, will be placed in a safe deposit box of the First Bank of Boulder.
Stu Redmond presented a broadside on the subject of food poisoning written by Dick Ellis and Laurie Constable, eye-catchingly titled, If You Eat, You Should Read This. He said Dick wanted to see it printed and nailed up all over Boulder before the big meeting on August 18th. Because there have already been 15 cases of food poisoning in Boulder, two of them quite serious. The committee voted 7-0 that Ralph should duplicate 1,000 copies of Dick's poster and get 10 people to help him put them up all over town. Susan Stern then presented another item that Dick and Laurie wanted to put before the meeting. We all wished one or the other of them could have been here. They both feel that there must be a burial committee. Dick's idea was that it should be put on the agenda of the public meeting and that it be presented not as a health hazard, because of the possibility it might cause panic, but as the decent thing to do. We all know there are surprisingly few corpses in Boulder in proportion to its pre-plague population, but we don't know why. Not that it matters much now. But there are still thousands of dead bodies, and they must be gotten rid of if we intend to stay here. Stu asked how serious the problem was at present, and Sue said she thought it would not become really serious until fall, when the dry hot weather usually turns damp. Larry made a motion that we add Dick's suggestion that a burial committee be formed to the agenda of the August 18th meeting. A motion was carried 7-0. Nick Andros was then recognized, and Ralph Brentner read his prepared comments, which I am here quoting verbatim. One of the most important questions this committee must deal with is whether or not it will agree to take Mother Abigail into its complete confidence. And shall she be told about everything that goes on at our meetings, both open and closed? The question can also be put the other way. Shall Mother Abigail agree to take this committee, and the permanent committee that will follow it, into her complete confidence? And shall the committee be told about all that goes on in her meetings with God or whoever, particularly the closed ones? That may sound like gibberish, but let me explain, because it's really a pragmatic question. We have to settle Mother Abigail's place in the community right away, because our problem is not just one of getting on our feet again. If that was all, we wouldn't really need her in the first place. As we all know, there is another problem, that of the man we sometimes call the dark man, or as Glenn puts it, the adversary. My proof for his existence is very simple, and I think most people in Boulder would agree with my reasoning, if they wanted to think of it at all. Here it is. I dreamed of Mother Abigail, and she was. I dreamed of the dark man, and therefore he must be, although I have never seen him. The people here love Mother Abigail, and I love her myself. But we won't get far, in fact we won't get anywhere, if we don't start off with her approval of what we're doing. So this early afternoon I went to see the lady and put the question to her directly, with all the bark on it. Will you go along? She said she would, but not without conditions. She was perfectly blunt. She said we should be perfectly free to guide the community in all worldly matters, her phrase, clearing the streets, allocating housing, getting the power back on. But she was also very clear about wanting to be consulted on all matters that have to do with the dark man. She believes we are all part of a chess game between God and Satan, that Satan's chief agent in this game is the adversary, whose name, she says, is Randall Flagg. The name he's using this time is how she puts it. That for reasons best known to himself, God has chosen her as his agent in this matter. She believes, and in this I happen to agree with her, that a struggle is coming, and it's going to be us or him. She thinks this struggle is the most important thing, and she's adamant about being consulted when our deliberations touch on it, and on him. Now, I don't want to get into the religious implications of all this or argue whether she's right or wrong, but it should be obvious that all implications aside, we have a situation we must cope with. So I have a series of motions. There was some discussion of Nick's statement. Nick made this motion. Can we as a committee agree not to discuss the theological, religious, or supernatural implications of the adversary matter during our meetings? By a 7-0 vote, the committee agreed to bar discussion on those matters, at least while we're in session. Nick then made this motion. Can we agree that the main private secret business of the committee is the question of how to deal with this force known as the Dark Man, the Adversary, or Randall Flagg? Glenn Bateman seconded the motion, adding that from time to time there might be other business, such as the real reason for the burial committee, that we should keep close to the vest. The motion carried 7-0. Nick then made his original motion that we keep Mother Abigail informed of all public and private business transacted by the committee. That motion was passed 7-0. Having disposed of the Mother Abigail business for the time being, the committee then moved on to the question of the Dark Man himself at Nick's request. He proposed that we send 3 volunteers west to join the Dark Man's people, the purpose being to gain intelligence about what's really going on over there. Sue Stern immediately volunteered. After some hot discussion of that, Glenn Bateman was recognized by Stu and put this motion on the floor. Resolved, that no one from our ad hoc committee or from the permanent committee be eligible to volunteer for this reconnaissance. Sue Stern wanted to know why not. Glenn, everyone respects your honest desire to help, Susan, but the fact is we simply don't know if the people we send will ever come back, or when, or in what shape. In the meantime, we have the not-so-inconsiderable job of getting things in Boulder back on a paying basis, if you'll pardon the slang. If you go, we'll have to fill your seat with someone new who would have to be briefed on the ground we've already covered. I just don't think we can afford all that lost time. Sue, I suppose you're right, or at least being sensible. But I do wonder sometimes if those 2 things are always the same, or even usually the same. What you're really saying is that we can't send anyone from the committee because we're all so fucking inexpendable. So we just, I don't know. Stu, lay back in the buckwheat? Sue, yes, thank you, that's just what I mean. We lay back in the buckwheat and send somebody over there, maybe to get crucified on a telephone pole, maybe something even worse. Ralph, what the hell could be worse? Sue, I don't know, but if anyone does know, it will be Flag. I just hate it. Glenn, you may hate it, but you've stated our position very succinctly. We're politicians here, the first politicians of the New Age. We just have to hope that our cause is more just than some of the causes for which politicians have sent people into life-or-death situations before this. Sue, I never thought I'd be a politician. Larry, welcome to the club. Glenn's motion that no one from the ad hoc committee should be one of the scouts was carried, gloomily, by a 7-0 vote. Fran Goldsmith then asked Nick what sort of qualifications we should look for in prospective undercover agents, and what we should expect them to find out. Nick, we won't know what there is to be learned until they come back, if they do come back. The point is, we have absolutely no idea what he's up to over there. We're more or less like fishermen using human bait. Stu said he thought the committee should pick the people it wanted to ask, and there was general agreement on this. By committee vote, most of the discussion from this point on has been transcribed into these excerpts verbatim from the audio tapes. It seemed important to have a permanent record of our deliberations on the matter of the scouts, or spies, because it turned out to be so delicate and so troubling. Larry, I've got a name I'd like to put into nomination if I could. I suppose it'll sound off the wall to those of you who don't know him, but it might be a really good idea. I'd like to send Judge Ferris. Sue, what, that old man? Larry, you must be nuts. Larry, he's the sharpest old guy I've ever met. He's only 70, for the record. Ronald Reagan was serving as president at an older age than that. Fran, that's not what I'd call a very strong recommendation. Larry, but he's hale and hearty. And I think the Dark Man might not suspect we'd send an old crock like Ferris to spy on him. And we have to take his suspicions into account, you know. He's got to be looking for a move like this, and I wouldn't be entirely surprised if he had border guards checking people coming in over there against a potential spy profile. And this'll sound brutal, I know, especially to Fran, but if we lose him, we haven't lost somebody with 50 good years in front of him. Fran, you're right, it sounds brutal. Larry, all I want to add is that I know the judge would say okay. He really wants to help, and I really think he could carry it off. Glenn, a point well taken. What does anybody else think? Ralph, I'll go either way because I don't know the gentleman, but I don't think we should throw the guy out just because he's old. After all, look who's in charge of this place, an old lady who's well over 100. Glenn, another point well taken. Stu,
You sound like a tennis ref, Baldy.
Sue. Listen, Larry, what if he fools the Dark Men and then drops dead of a heart attack while he's busting his hump to get back here?
Stu. That could happen to just about anyone, or an accident.
Sue. I agree, but with an old man the odds go way up.
Larry.
That's true, but you don't know the judge, Sue. If you did, you'd see that the advantages outweigh the disadvantages. He's really smart. Defense rests.
Stu. I think Larry's right. It's the sort of thing Flag might not expect. I second the motion. Those in favor?
Committee voted aye, 7-0.
Sue.
Well, I went along with yours, Larry. Maybe you'll go along with mine.
Larry.
Yeah, this is politics, all right.
General laughter. Who is it?
Sue. Dana.
Ralph.
Dana who?
Sue.
Dana Jurgens. She's got more guts than any woman I ever knew. Of course, I know she isn't 70, but I think if we put the idea to her, she'd go along.
Fran.
Yes, if we really have to do this, I think she'd be good. I second the nomination.
Stu. Okay, it's been moved and seconded that we ask Dana Jurgens along for the ride. Those in favor?
Committee voted aye, 7-0.
Glenn.
Okay, who's number three?
Nick, read by Ralph.
If Fran disliked Larry's, I'm afraid she's really going to dislike mine.
I nominate
Ralph.
Nick, you're crazy. You don't mean it.
Stu, come on, Ralph, just read it.
Ralph.
Well, it says here he wants to nominate Tom Cullen.
Uproar from the committee.
Stu.
Okay, Nick has the floor. He's been writing like a bastard, so you better read it, Ralph.
Nick.
First of all, I know Tom just as well as Larry knows the judge, and probably better. He loves Mother Abigail. He'd do anything for her, including roasting over a slow fire. I really mean that. No hype. He'd set himself on fire for her if she asked him to.
Fran.
Oh, Nick, nobody's arguing that, but Tom is...
Stu. Let it go, Fran. Nick's got the floor.
Nick. My second point is the same one Larry made about the judge. The adversary is not going to expect us to send a retarded person as a spy. Your combined reactions to the idea are maybe the best argument in favor of the idea. My third and last point is that, while Tom may be retarded, he is not a halfwit. He saved my life once when a tornado came, and he reacted much faster than anyone else I know would have done. Tom is childish, but even a child can learn to do certain things if he is drilled and taught and then drilled some more. I see no problem at all in giving Tom a very simple story to memorize. In the end, they'll likely assume that we sent him away because...
Sue.
Because we didn't want him polluting our gene pool?
Say, that's good.
Nick. Because he is retarded. He can even say he's mad at the people who sent him away and would like to get back at them. The one imperative which would have to be drilled into him would be to never change his story, no matter what.
Fran.
Oh, no, I can't believe...
Stu. Come on, Nick has the floor. Let's keep it orderly.
Fran. Yes, I'm sorry.
Nick.
Some of you may feel that because Tom is retarded, it would be easier to shake him from his story than it would be someone with a wider intelligence, but...
Larry.
Yeah.
Nick. But actually, the reverse is true. If I tell Tom he simply must stick to the story I gave him, stick to it no matter what, he will. A so-called normal person could only stand up to so many hours of water torture, or so many electric shocks or splinters under the fingernails.
Fran.
It wouldn't come to that, would it? Would it? I mean, nobody really thinks it would come to that, do they?
Nick.
Before saying, okay, I give up, I'll tell you what I know. Tom simply wouldn't do that. If he goes over his story enough times, he won't just have it by heart. He'll come to almost believe it is true. Nobody will be able to shake him on it. I just want to make it clear that I think in a number of ways, Tom's retardation is actually a plus in a mission like this. Mission sounds like a pretentious word, but that's just what it is.
Stu.
Is that it, Ralph?
Ralph.
There's a little more.
Sue.
If he actually starts to live his cover story, Nick,
How in the hell will he know when it's time to come back?
Ralph, pardon me, ma'am, but it looks like that's what some of this is about.
Sue,
oh.
Nick, read by Ralph. Tom can be given a post-hypnotic suggestion before we send him out. Again, this is not just blue skying. When I had this idea, I asked Stan Nagatny if he would try to hypnotize Tom. Stan used to do it as a parlor trick at parties sometimes, I heard him say. Well, Stan didn't think it would work, but Tom went under in about 6 seconds.
Stu, I'll be. Old Stan knows how to do that, huh?
Nick, the reason I thought Tom might be ultra-susceptible dates back to when I met him in Oklahoma. He's apparently developed the knack, over a long period of years, of hypnotizing himself to a degree. It helps him make connections. He couldn't understand what I was up to on the day I met him, why I didn't talk to him or answer any of his questions. I kept putting my hand on my mouth and then my throat to show I was mute, but he didn't get it at all. Then all at once he just turned off. I can't explain it any better than that. He became perfectly still. His eyes went far away. Then he came out of it exactly the way a subject comes out of it when the hypnotist tells him it's time to wake up. And he knew, just like that. He went into himself and came up with the answer.
Glenn, that's really amazing.
Stu,
it sure is.
Nick, I had Stan give him a post-hypnotic suggestion when we tried this about 5 days ago now. The suggestion was that when Stan said, I sure would like to see an elephant, Tom would feel a great urge to go into the corner and stand on his head. Stan sprang it on him about half an hour after he woke Tom up, and Tom hustled right over into the corner and stood on his head. All the toys and marbles fell out of his pants pockets. Then he sat down and grinned at us and said, Now I wonder why Tom Cullen went and did that.
Glenn, I can just hear him, too.
Nick, anyway, all this elaborate hypnosis stuff is just an introduction to two very simple points. One, we can plant a post-hypnotic suggestion that Tom return at a certain time. The obvious way would be to do this by the moon, the full moon. Two, by putting him into deep hypnosis when he gets back, we'd get almost perfect recall of everything he saw.
Ralph. That's the end of what Nick's got written down. Wow.
Larry. It sounds like that old movie, The Manchurian Candidate, to me.
Stu.
What?
Larry.
Nothing.
Sue.
I have a question, Nick. Would you also program Tom, I guess that's the right word, not to give out any information about what we're doing?
Glenn.
Nick, let me answer that, and if your reasoning is different, just shake your head. I would say that Tom doesn't need to be programmed at all. Let him spill anything and everything he knows about us. We're keeping our business, as it relates to Flag, in camera anyway, and we're not doing much else that he couldn't guess on his own, even if his crystal ball is on the blink.
Nick.
Exactly.
Glenn.
Okay, I'm going to second Nick's motion right on the spot. I think we have everything to win and nothing to lose. It's a tremendously daring and original idea.
Stu.
It's been moved and seconded. We can have a little further discussion if you want, but only a little. We'll be here all night if we don't look lively.
Is there any further discussion?
Fran.
You bet there is. You said we have everything to win and nothing to lose, Glenn. Well, what about Tom? What about our own goddamn souls? Maybe it doesn't bother you guys to think about people sticking things under Tom's fingernails and giving him electric shocks, but it bothers me. How can you be so cold-blooded? And Nick, hypnotizing him so he'd behave like a chicken with its head stuck in a bag. You ought to be ashamed. I thought he was your friend.
Stu.
Fran.
No, I'm going to have my say. I won't wash my hands of the committee or even walk off in a huff if I'm voted down, but I'm going to have my say. Do you really want to take that sweet, foggy boy and turn him into a human U-2 plane? Don't any of you understand that's the same as starting all the old shit over again? Can't you see that? What do we do if they kill him, Nick? What do we do if they kill all of them, breed up some new bugs, an improved version of Captain Trips?
There was a pause here while Nick wrote out a response. Nick, read by Ralph. The things Fran has brought up have affected me pretty deeply, but I stand by my nomination. No, I don't feel good about standing Tom on his head, and I don't feel good about sending him into a situation where he might be tortured and then killed. I'll only point out again that he would be doing it for Mother Abigail, and her ideas and her God, not for us. I also truly believe that we have to use any means at our disposal to end the threat this being poses. He's crucifying people over there. I'm sure of that from my dreams, and I know some of you others have had that dream too. Mother Abigail has had it herself, and I know that Flag is evil. If anyone works up a new strain of Captain Trips, Franny, it will be him, to use on us. I'd like to stop him while we still can. Fran. Those things are all true, Nick. I can't argue them. I know he's bad. For all I know, he may be Satan's imp, as Mother Abigail says. But we're putting our hand to the same switch in order to stop him. Remember Animal Farm? They looked from the pigs to the men and could not tell the difference. I guess what I really want to hear you say, even if it's Ralph who reads it, is that if we do have to pull that switch in order to stop him, if we do, that we'll be able to let go once it's over. Can you say that? Nick. Not for sure, I guess. Not for sure. Fran. Then I vote no. If we must send people into the West, let's at least send people who know what they are in for. Stu. Anyone else? Sue. I'm against it too, but for more practical reasons. If we go on the way we're headed, we're going to end up with an old man and a Phoebe. Pardon the expression, I like him too, but that's what he is. I'm against it, and now I'll shut up. Glenn. Call the question, Stu. Stu. Okay, let's go around the table. I vote aye. Franny? Fran. Nay. Stu. Glenn? Glenn. Aye. Stu. Suze? Sue. Nay. Stu. Nick? Nick. Aye. Stu. Ralph? Ralph. Well, I don't like it that much either, but if Nick's for it, I gotta go along. Aye. Stu. Larry? Larry. Want me to be frank? I think the idea sucks so bad I feel like a pay toilet. This is the kind of stuff you get when you're at the top, I guess. Neat fucking place to be. I vote aye. Stu. Motion's carried 5-2. Fran. Stu? Stu, yes? Fran. I'd like to change my vote. If we're really going to put Tom into it, we'd better do it together. I'm sorry I made such a fuss, Nick. I know it hurts you. I can see it on your face. It's so crazy. Why did any of this have to happen? It sure isn't like being on the sorority prom committee, I'll tell you that. Franny votes aye. Sue. Me too, then. United Front. Nixon stands firm, says I am not a crook. Aye. Stu. Amended vote is 7-0. Here's a hanky, Fran. And I'd like the record to show that I love you. Larry. On that note, I think we should adjourn. Sue. I second that emotion. Stu. It has been moved and seconded by Zippy and Zippy's mom that we adjourn. Those in favor, raise your hands. Those opposed, be prepared to get a can of beer dumped on your head. The vote to adjourn was 7-0. Coming to bed, Stu? Yeah, is it late? Almost midnight. Late enough. Stu came in from the balcony. He was wearing jockey shorts and nothing else. Their whiteness was nearly dazzling against his tanned skin. Franny, propped up in bed with a Coleman gas lantern on the night table next to her, found herself amazed again by the confident depth of her love for him. Thinking about the meeting? Yes, I was. He poured himself a glass of water from the pitcher on the night table and grimaced at the flat, boiled taste. I thought you made a wonderful moderator. Glenn asked if you'd do it at the public meeting, didn't he? Is it bothering you? Did you decline? No, I said I would. I guess I can do that. I was thinking about sending those three across the mountains. It's a dirty business sending out spies. You were right, Franny. Only trouble is Nick was right, too. In a case like that,
What you gonna do?
Vote your conscience and then get the best night's sleep you can, I guess.
She reached out to touch the Coleman lamp switch.
Ready for the light?
Yeah. She put it out and he swung into bed beside her.
Good night, Franny, he said. I love you.
She lay looking at the ceiling. She had made her peace with Tom Cullen, but that smudged chocolate thumbprint stayed on her mind.
Every dog has its day, Fran.
Maybe I ought to tell Stu right now, she thought. But if there was a problem, it was her problem. She would just have to wait, watch, and see if anything happened. It was a long time before she slept.
Chapter 52. In the early hours of the morning, Mother Abigail lay sleepless in her bed. She was trying to pray. She got up without making a light and knelt down in her white cotton nightgown. She pressed her forehead to her Bible, which was open to the Acts of the Apostles, the conversion of doer old Saul on the Damascus Road. He had been blinded by the light, and on the Damascus Road the scales had fallen from his eyes. Acts was the last book in the Bible where doctrine was backed up by miracles, and what were miracles but the divine hand of God at work upon the earth? And oh, there were scales on her eyes, and would they ever be shaken free? The only sounds in the room were the faint hiss of the oil lamp, the tick of her wind-up west clocks, and her low muttering voice.
Show me my sin, Lord. I don't know. I know I've gone and missed something you meant for me to see. I can't sleep, I can't take a crap, and I don't feel you, Lord. I feel like I'm praying into a dead phone, and this is a bad time for that to happen. How have I offended thee? I'm listening, Lord, listening for the still, small voice in my heart.
And she did listen. She put her arthritis-bunched fingers over her eyes and leaned forward even farther and tried to clear her mind. But all was dark there, dark like her skin, dark like the fallow earth that waits for the good seed.
Please, my Lord, please, my Lord.
But the image that rose was of a lonely stretch of dirt road in a sea of corn. There was a woman with a gunny sack full of freshly killed chickens, and the weasels came. They darted forward and made snatches at the bag. They could smell the blood, the old blood of sin and the fresh blood of sacrifice. She heard the old woman raise her voice to God, but her tone was weak and whining, a petulant voice, not begging humbly that God's will be done, whatever her place in that will's scheme of things might be, but demanding that God save her so she could finish the work, her work, as if she knew the mind of God and could suborn his will to hers. The weasels grew bolder still. The croaker sack began to fray as they twitched and pulled it. Her fingers were too old, too weak, and when the chickens were gone, the weasels would still be hungry and they would come for her. Yes, they would. And then the weasels were scattering. They had run squeaking into the night, leaving the contents of the sack half devoured. And she thought exultantly, God has saved me after all. Praise his name. God has saved his good and faithful servant.
Not God, old woman. Me.
In her vision, she turned, fear leaping hotly into her throat with a taste like fresh copper. And there, shouldering its way out of the corn like a ragged silver ghost, was a huge Rocky Mountain timber wolf, its jaws hanging open in a sardonic grin, its eyes burning. There was a beaten silver collar around its thick neck, a thing of handsome, barbarous beauty, and from it dangled a small stone of blackest jet. And in the center was a small red flaw, like an eye, or a key. She crossed herself and forked the sign of the evil eye at this dreadful apparition, but its jaws only grinned wider, and between them lolled the naked pink muscle of its tongue.
I'm coming for you, Mother. Not now, but soon. We'll run you like dogs run deer. I am all the things you think, but I'm more. I'm the magic man. I'm the man who speaks for the latter age. Your own people know me best, Mother. They call me John the Conqueror.
Go, leave me in the name of the Lord God Almighty. But she was so terrified, not for the people around her, which were represented in her dream by the chickens in the sack, but for herself. She was afraid in her soul, afraid for her soul.
Your God has no power over me, Mother. His vessel is weak.
No, not true. My strength is the strength of 10. I shall mount up with wings as eagles.
But the wolf only grinned and drew closer. She shrank from its breath, which was heavy and savage. This was the terror at noonday and the terror which flieth at midnight, and she was afraid. She was in her extremity of fear, and the wolf, still grinning, began to speak in 2 voices, asking and then answering itself.
Who brought water from the rock when we were thirsty?
I did, the wolf answered in a petulant, half-crowing, half-cowering voice.
Who saved us when we did faint? Asked the grinning wolf, its muzzle now only bare inches from her, its breath that of a living abattoir.
I did, the wolf whined, drawing closer still, its grinning muzzle full of sharp death, its eyes red and haughty.
Oh, fall down and praise my name. I am the bringer of water in the desert. Praise my name. I am the good and faithful servant who brings water in the desert, and my name is also the name of my master.
The mouth of the wolf opened wide to swallow her.
My name, she muttered. Praise my name. Praise God from whom all blessings flow. Praise him, ye creatures here below.
She raised her head and looked around the room in a kind of stupor. Her Bible had fallen to the floor. There was dawnlight in the eastward-facing window.
Oh, my Lord, she cried in a great and quavering voice.
Who brought water from the rock when we were thirsty?
Was that it? Dear God, was that it?
Was that why the scales had covered her eyes, making her blind to the things she should know? Bitter tears began to fall from her eyes, and she got slowly and painfully to her feet and walked to the window. Arthritis jabbed blunt darning needles into the joints of her hips and knees. She looked out and knew what she had to do now. She went back to the closet and pulled the white cotton nightgown over her head. She dropped it on the floor. Now she stood naked, revealing a body so lapped with wrinkles that it might have been the bed of time's great river.
"Thy will be done," she said, and began to dress.
An hour later she was walking slowly west on Mapleton Avenue toward the wooded tangles and narrow-throated defiles beyond town. Stu was at the power plant with Nick when Glenn burst in. Without preamble, he said, "Mother Abigail, she's gone." Nick looked at him sharply. "What are you talking about?" Stu asked, at the same time drawing Glenn away from the crew wrapping copper wire on one of the blown turbines. Glenn nodded. He had ridden a bike the 5 miles out here, and he was still trying to catch his breath.
"I went over to tell her a little about the meeting last night and to play her the tape if she wanted to hear it. I wanted her to know about Tom because I was uneasy about the whole idea. What Franny had to say kind of worked on me in the wee hours, I guess. I wanted to do it early because Ralph said there's another 2 parties coming in today, and you know she likes to greet them. I went over around 8:30. She didn't answer my knock, so I went on in. I thought if she was asleep, I'd just leave. But I wanted to make sure she wasn't dead or anything. She's so old."
Nick's gaze never left Glenn's lips.
"But she wasn't there at all. And I found this on her pillow."
He handed them a paper towel. Written on it in large and trembling strokes was this message. "I must be gone a bit now. I've sinned and presumed to know the mind of God. My sin has been pride, and he wants me to find my place in his work again. I will be with you again soon if it is God's will. Abby Freemantle."
"I'll be a son of a bitch," Stu said. "What do we do now? What do you think, Nick?"
Nick took the note and read it again. He handed it back to Glenn.
The fierceness had died out of his face, and he only looked sad.
"I guess we'll have to move up that meeting to tonight," Glenn said.
Nick shook his head. He took out his pad, wrote, tore it off, and handed it to Glenn. Stu read it over his shoulder. "Man proposes, God disposes. Mother A was fond of that one, used to quote it frequently. Glenn, you yourself said she was other-directed. God, or her own mind, or her delusions, or whatever. What's to do? She's gone. We can't change it."
"But the uproar," Stu began.
"Sure there's going to be an uproar," Glenn said.
"Nick, shouldn't we at least have a meeting of the committee and discuss it?"
Nick jotted, "What purpose? Why have a meeting that can't accomplish anything?"
"Well, we could get up a search party. She can't have gone far."
Nick double-circled the phrase, "Man proposes, God disposes." Below it he wrote, "If you found her, how would you bring her back? Chains?"
"Jesus, no," Stu exclaimed.
"But we can't just let her wander around, Nick. She's got some crazy idea she's offended God. What if she feels like she has to go off into the friggin' wilderness like some Old Testament guy?"
Nick wrote, "I'm almost positive that's just what she's done."
"Well, there you go."
Glenn put a hand on Stu's arm.
"Slow down a minute, East Texas. Let's look at the implications of this."
"To hell with the implications. I don't see no implications in leaving an old woman to wander around day and night until she dies of exposure."
"She is not just any old woman. She is Mother Abigail, and around here she's the Pope. If the Pope decides he has to walk to Jerusalem, do you argue with him if you're a good Catholic?"
"God damn it, it's not the same thing, and you know it."
"Yes, it is the same thing. It is. At least that's how the people in the Free Zone are going to see it. Stu, are you prepared to say for sure that God didn't tell her to go out into the bushes?"
"No, but..."
Nick had been writing, and now he showed the paper to Stu, who had to puzzle out some of the words. Nick's handwriting was usually impeccable, but this was hurried, perhaps impatient. "Stu, this changes nothing, except that it will probably hurt the Free Zone's morale. Not even sure that will happen. People aren't going to scatter just because she's gone. It does mean we won't have to clear our plans with her right now. Maybe that's best."
"I'm going crazy," Stu said. "Sometimes we talk about her as an obstacle to get around, like she was a roadblock. Sometimes you talk about her like she was the Pope, and she couldn't do anything wrong if she wanted to. And it just so happens that I like her. What do you want, Nicky? Someone stumbling over her body this fall in one of those box canyons west of town? You want us to leave her out there so she can make a holy meal for the crows?"
"Stu," Glenn said gently, "it was her decision to go."
"Oh, goddamn, what a mess," Stu said.
By noon, the news of Mother Abigail's disappearance had swept the community. As Nick had predicted, the general feeling was more one of unhappy resignation than alarm. The sense of the community was that she must have gone off to pray for guidance, so she could help them pick the right path to follow at the mass meeting on the 18th.
"I don't want to blaspheme by calling her God," Glenn said over a scratch lunch in the park.
"But she is sort of God by proxy. You can measure the strength of any society's faith by seeing how much that faith weakens when its empiric object is removed."
"Run that one by me again."
"When Moses smashed the golden calf, the Israelites stopped worshipping it. When a flood inundated the temple of Baal, the Malachites decided Baal wasn't such a hot god anyway. But Jesus has been out to lunch for 2,000 years, and people not only still follow his teachings, they live and die believing he'll come back eventually, and it will be business as usual when he does. That's the way the Free Zone feels about Mother Abigail. These people are perfectly certain she is going to come back. Have you talked to them?"
"Yeah," Stu said. "I can't believe it. There's an old woman wandering around out there, and everyone says, 'Ho-hum, I wonder if she'll bring back the Ten Commandments on stone tablets in time for the meeting.'"
"Maybe she will," Glenn said somberly. "Anyway, not everyone is saying ho-hum. Ralph Brentner is practically tearing his hair out by the roots."
"Good for Ralph."
He looked at Glenn closely.
"What about you, Baldy? Where are you in all of this?"
"I wish you wouldn't call me that. It's not at all dignified. But I'll tell you, it's a little bit funny.
Old East Texas turns out to be a lot more immune from the God spell she's cast over this community than the agnostic old bear sociologist. I think she'll be back. Somehow I just do. What does Franny think? I don't know. I haven't seen her at all this morning. For all I know, she's out there eating locusts and wild honey with Mother Abigail. He stared at the flat irons, rising high in the blue haze of early afternoon. Jesus, Glenn, I hope that old lady is all right. Fran didn't even know Mother Abigail was gone. She had spent the morning at the library, reading up on gardening. Nor was she the only student. She saw two or three people with books on farming, a bespectacled young man of about 25 poring over a book called Seven Independent Power Sources for Your Home, and a pretty blonde girl of about 14 with a battered paperback titled 600 Simple Recipes. She left the library around noon and strolled down to Walnut Street. She was halfway home when she met Shirley Hammett, the older woman who had been traveling with Dana, Susan, and Patty Kroger. Shirley had improved strikingly since then. Now she looked like a brisk and pretty matron about town. She stopped and greeted Fran.
"When do you think she'll be back? I've been asking everybody. If this town had a newspaper, I'd write it up for the people poll. Like, what do you think of Senator Bunghole's stand on oil depletion? That sort of thing."
"When will who be back?"
"Mother Abigail, of course. Where have you been, girl? Cold storage?"
"What is all this?" Franny asked, alarmed. "What's happened?"
"That's just it. Nobody really knows."
And Shirley told Fran what had been going on while Fran had been at the library.
"She just left?" Franny asked, frowning.
"Yes, of course she'll be back," Shirley added confidently. "The note said so."
"If it is God's will?"
"That's just a manner of speaking, I'm sure," Shirley said, and looked at Fran with a touch of coldness.
"Well, I hope so. Thanks for telling me, Shirley. Are you still having headaches?"
"Oh, no, they're all gone now. I'll be voting for you, Fran."
"Hmm?"
Her mind was far away, chasing this new information, and for a moment she hadn't the slightest idea what Shirley could be talking about.
"For the permanent committee."
"Oh, well, thanks. I'm not even sure I want the job."
"You'll do fine. You and Susie both. Got to get going, Fran. See you."
They parted. Fran hurried toward the apartment, wanting to see if Stu knew anything else. Coming so soon after their meeting last night, the old woman's disappearance struck her around her heart with a kind of superstitious dread. She didn't like not being able to pass on their major decisions, like the one to send people west, to Mother Abigail for judgment. With her gone, Fran felt too much of the responsibility on her own shoulders. When she got home, the apartment was empty. She had missed Stu by about 15 minutes. The note under the sugar bowl said simply, "Back by 9:30. I'm with Ralph and Harold. No worry, Stu." "Ralph and Harold?" she thought, and felt a sudden twinge of dread that had nothing to do with Mother Abigail. Now why should I be afraid for Stu? My God, if Harold tried to do something, well, something funny, Stu would tear him apart. Unless Harold sneaked up behind him or something, and...
She clutched at her elbows, feeling cold, wondering what Stu could be doing with Ralph and Harold.
Back by 9:30. God, that seemed a long time away.
She stood in the kitchen a moment longer, frowning down at her knapsack, which she had put on the counter.
"I'm with Ralph and Harold."
So Harold's little house on Outer Arapahoe would be deserted until 9:30 tonight. Unless, of course, they were there, and if they were, she could join them and satisfy her curiosity. She could bike out there in no time. If no one was there, she might find something that would set her mind at rest, or... But she wouldn't let herself think about that.
"Set your mind at rest?" the interior voice nagged. "Or just make it crazier. Suppose you do find something funny. What then? What will you do about it?"
She didn't know. She didn't, in fact, have the least tiny smidgen of an idea.
No worry. Stu. But there was worry. That thumbprint in her diary meant there was worry. Because a man who would steal your diary and pilfer your thoughts
was a man without much principle or scruple. A man like that might creep up behind someone he hated and give a push off a high place, or use a rock, or a knife, or a gun. No worry.